This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question comes from Gerald Callier, who asks, if light photons lack mass, why do they not escape from black holes?
This is a very good question indeed. Now, what Galileo is supposed to have discovered is that the mass of something or the weight of something doesn't affect how fast it falls under gravity. And what we now know is that that effect continues all the way down to mass zero. That's a bit surprising. You can sort of see intuitively why that's true, because if you the bigger a thing is, the more gravity pulls it, but also the more gravity needs to pull it in order to make it move, because it's bigger and it has more inertia. So it's not too surprising that the different sizes of or different masses of things get falling at the same speed. What is surprising is that on a technical level, why that's true. There's no particular reason, and it's kind of theoretically a bit surprising, that the mass something has for gravity and the mass it has for inertia and motion are the same. There's no reason, kind of a priori, that those things should be the same. For example, with the electric field or the magnetic field, things are pulled by a different amount depending on what their electric charge or the magnetic charge is. So it's a bit of a mystery, actually. It's a theoretical mystery about the universe, why that's true and why those things are ultimately true. So the ultimate answer to your question is we don't know. But the proximate answer is because you don't need to have mass to be pulled by gravity.
That's a really interesting situation.
Yeah,
that's kind of made my mind go a bit funny. Yeah. Moving on. Our next question, in fact, our next two questions are from Dennis Rockwell, who first of all asks, is there momentum transfer between dark and normal matter during a gravitational encounter like there is between two bodies of normal matter?
The answer is yes, absolutely there is. Dark matter interacts under gravity exactly the same as normal matter, that's as far as we know. And indeed, that seems to be the only way it interacts. It doesn't interact by the electromagnetic force that we normally have. Indeed, that's why we call it dark, because it doesn't have these electromagnetic interactions. So the primary way it interacts is by gravity, just like ordinary matter. But we don't know, for example, whether there's other forces that affect it as well. Some candidates for dark matter are WIMPs, which stands for weakly interacting massive particles, and so those interact by the weak interaction as well. So we know it does by the gravitational force. We know it doesn't by the electromagnetic force, but the other ones are up for grabs.
How do we know that it doesn't interact by the EM force, the electromagnetic force?
Just because it's dark. So electromagnetic interactions involve the reflection of light or the emission of light or the absorption of light. And we've never detected that by dark matter, otherwise it wouldn't be dark.
Okay, cool. And his second question was that if there is such a transfer, would the loss of energy in a two-neutron star system that's generally presumed to produce gravity waves be accounted for by momentum transfer to dark matter that's been flung out of the system's gravity well by these encounters?
Interesting question again. So as I just said, dark matter doesn't interact electromagnetically, and electromagnetic interactions are the source of pressure in materials. So that's electrons and protons bouncing off each other in a way that doesn't happen in dark matter. And that means that you don't really get collapsed structures made of dark matter like stars. So when you've got a star, it's made from a cloud of gas primordially, and that cloud of gas, in order to become a star and collapse to it, has to lose a huge amount of angular momentum. It's spinning round too fast to be able to collapse into a star. The only way it can lose that momentum to kind of undergo that collapse is by heating up and emitting that radiation, which takes the angular momentum away with it. And if it can't heat up under pressure, which it can't because it's got no electromagnetic interactions, it can't lose angular momentum, so it can't collapse. So the answer is we don't get dark matter objects that are as collapsed as stars and form these kind of tightly bound small objects, which would have enough momentum mass and gravitational forces to do the kind of things that we need to do in a two-neutron star system. So the answer is that we just don't have the dark matter that's as dense as it needs to be to mimic the gravitational wave effects that we're expecting there or that we're seeing there.
Fantastic. Our last question comes from Rob Peck, who asks, surely the first stars formed after the Big Bang could have achieved thousands or even millions of solar masses with so much material floating around at that time. If they all spontaneously made black holes at their centres, could the supermassive black holes at the centres of galaxies be the remnants of the first stars?
So there's a couple of different things to clarify here. The first thing to say is that although the average matter density at, say, redshift 10, when supermassive black holes were believed to have formed, was 1,000 times greater than it is today, that's still way, way, way less than stellar mass densities or the mass density you need to make a black hole. It's still tiny compared to that. And the way I like to think of this is that if you took all the matter in the universe, in the whole universe, and squashed it down so it was the density of water, say, which isn't even a particularly dense thing. It's pretty dense, but not super dense. All the matter in the universe at density of water would have a radius of about 10 light years.
10 light years?
10 light years. So it's
really
tiny. It's tiny, and that's because space is very, very empty. So although you do have loads of matter floating around in this kind of high redshift universe, you really don't have enough to form stellar densities just by sort of hanging around as easily. And having said that, there are much larger, in terms of solar masses, stars existing at high redshifts. That's really to do with chemistry rather than to do with physics. That's just to do with what happens when stars have no metal in them, because there's no metal in these early times. They can form much larger levels.
And by metal you mean kind of anything that's heavier than helium?
Exactly. I mean astronomy metal, which means anything that's not hydrogen or helium, which is a little bit of abuse of nomenclature that astronomers like to do. Also, having said that, the supermassive black holes that we do see in the universe could indeed be remnants of this early population. And there are a couple of different models for how this could have worked, exactly how we could get from these, you know, early high density population stars to the supermassive black holes we see today. In particular, we know there are more quasars in the early universe, and we think quasars are black holes with jets coming out of them. So we do expect there to be, you know, black holes forming early and in sort of larger numbers than we have today. So it's entirely possible that the supermassive black holes are indeed the remnants of these early populations. Yes.
Cool. That's really interesting stuff. And if you have any astronomical questions that you want answering, then send them in via all the usual channels.